Also, just to clarify, the second thing that we have to keep that it has been from today's it will also as to now that it has been taken to take soldiers back to the border.
Yeah.
What is going to happen with the country? We public finance management has made provision that for those unforeseen circumstances, then the adjustment can be made. But also, do not only invite them, we will invite much of the people around. So, thinking that then, we are agreed with that.
Sounds
like
but in the process of them coming back, we may have to ask two questions that they must also prepare around.
Mm-hmm.
For an example, when they talk about this 250 hours that was reduced from 550.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know in terms of monetary term what they're talking about. So they must be able to quantify to say, if we go back to this 550, because you're going to lose your capability of flying. This is what we need in the fiscus to inject it back into that. So if they can answer that question. I think the next one, if they say in the soldiers' capacity nationally is 70,000, and they most of others are in the missions in the continent, and with the new mandate of redeployment, whether we're going to have a sufficient capacity of the personnel to do what has to be done in terms of this work. Because if it's 70,000, it's less than security, private security company personnel.
And that is huge.
And that in itself is a threat. It's a constituted threat to the country. So I think that's what perhaps they need to answer when they come back. Those two probably questions. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, I just think they should also, I agree with Honourable Ramaphosa, but they should also look at their budget and see whether there are any items that they can reprioritize, and that we can shift and move in the right direction.
The difficulty that we have with us now. Is that now let's invite them just here, be open-minded about it. What is it that they want to do? Of course, these questions we're putting it to them. What kind of support do they want from us? And the transitional arrangement, as the police have been manning now those borders, But that's the issue. I think the main issue is that maybe that we should also be careful of is that the Portfolio Committee on Defense has not come to us to say this budget is not sufficient. We're taking it from a public submission.
Yeah.
But the public is important in terms of the law, in terms of the Constitution. It's important to hear the views of the public. But what we're trying to do is to say we have received this submission and these are the issues. Is this submission, do you agree with this submission? The issues that Honorable Ramachandran is raising, what are the implications of reducing those hours from that requirement of 550, downscaling them? Will our pilots still be rated as the best? South African pilots are one of the best in the country. I mean, if you travel around, we have traveled on these international flights. When they land, so you're not sure if you'll still be alive, you know. And people clap hands. In South Africa, we take it for granted. When it lands, we don't even understand whether it's landing or what. You will just hear when they say welcome to Cape Town or wherever. In other countries, landing is a big deal. So, Honourable Members, then you will be informed when the result is going to appear before us. Thank you very much. But if I will assist us with it today. Okay, our program is very tight. We must have sufficient time for compiling the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Honorable Members Pemore. My name is Malusi Kikana. I'm a retired government employee. I made the submission because I've spent quite a considerable amount of time working in the public service. I've learned quite a lot, and my patriotism in making sure that things that attracted me to the public service continue to happen has not abated simply because I've left government. And I've learned a lot from the past mistakes that I have noticed by others and myself as an implementer. And I think one makes the submission really in the interest of making sure that the experience I've gained over the last, you know, 7-8 years at the expense of government, free university, you know, doesn't get, you know, lost somewhere. My day job, I mine coal in MLO and Middleburg and extended buyer. But that's what I do in terms of my day-to-day job. But I'm also the chairman of the board of directors of Kula Enterprise Finance Limited, the position that I was appointed by cabinet on the 24th of February this year. And I was also requested to sit on the board as just an ordinary non-executive director of Itala Development Finance, which I've been doing that since this year as well, just to try and share some of my little experiences in my youth. Chairperson, I've got a presentation here which will make some illustrations. I know that honorable members have got the written things, so I'll almost like the PowerPoint presentation when I come to the appropriate point, areas. But really today, just to, that when one looks, and it's not just this budget, but it's a matter that I've been pursuing and looking at over the last 2 years at least, 2 to 3 years. One looks at the analysis, or when one analyzes the appropriation bill, you come to the following findings, and these are very strong findings, which one can back up with data. The first is that the fiscal policy stance, or the framework, as passed through the budget, or this appropriation bill, is pro-cyclical, and therefore, in my view, stimulus or will stand South Africa prospect for growth. The opposite is to be counter-cyclical. If you're going down, this is what President Khalim in his budget speech of 2008 said, you know, that we'll try to have a counter-cyclical budget, but when one looks at the current budget, it's actually the opposite. It is procyclical. It increases when we're in good years, it decreases when we're in bad years, when it's supposed to be the opposite. Secondly, the allocations that have been made per this bill of budget, as has happened with the previous budget, will continue to increase inequality and negatively affect maybe not only the black people, but the poor in this country, because I think inequality is no longer just a white and black issue. I think there are equally a number of, white people that fall into that bracket. So it will increase inequality. We saw that happening during the growth years, and I believe that if we continue along the same line, that will happen. Allocations seem to be made arbitrarily, with no evidence of performance measures being tabled to justify expenditure. And I think when one gives you some of the examples, you'll begin to see why one says this is arbitrary, because any right-thinking person will not make those kind of decisions. Now, moving on to the analysis of and findings, South Africa's number one priority, and probably the overarching goal, has to be about job creation. I think all the priorities that government has, in my view, are secondary. Creating jobs for our people is the most important. Having attained political freedom, economic emancipation is now the most important ideal that our democratic dispensation must afford its people. Over the last 16 years of our democracy, it is evident that we have made a lot of progress in this direction, but a lot more remains to be done. There have also been unintended mistakes committed by government and the private sector, as one will point out. So the comments on this appropriation bill, Chairperson and honorable members, are intended to ensure that we do not repeat those mistakes. In my view, South Africa to grow, we need to do the following and pursue the following strategies very vigorously. One is education and skills development, and that is already happening. Growth of small, micro and medium enterprises, I think there's very little of that happening. And obviously increase in fixed direct investment by local firms that has been affected by, and government, that has been affected by the recession, but that has to continue to happen. And also increase in foreign direct investment, which has not been happening as we would have liked to see it happen. So one moves to then to say, Chairperson, one cannot just motivate for more resources, but I think better and efficient allocation that reflects our developmental state. Moving on to education and skills development, I would like to pay attention to that matter. The South African government has since 1994 invested vast resources in education. If you look at the 1996 budget, which was the first budget that you can actually trace on the website, it actually looked at the amount of money we spent on education in 2006 is equal to the total budget our government had in 1996. So if our budget had, if now we spend 140 billion, it was exactly the total fiscal that we had in 1996. So it's by no means small amount of money. And also in 1999, with the passage of National Skills Development Act, additional resources have been dedicated towards the development of workers, largely through the on-the-job training programs. Honorable members will know that in the National Skills Development Act, there's what they call Section 18A learners and Section 18-2 learners. 18-1 learners are those learners who have been trained on the job. Almost 80% of resources are dedicated towards training of people on the job. 20% goes to the National Skills Fund, and that is meant for people who are unemployed. Unfortunately, despite the investment, quality has not improved, as everybody says, and pass rates have remained marginal, especially for black people. When we analyze all matric pass rates since 1994, one finds that the pass rate for black, especially African learners, remains very low. So when you hear that there's 65% overall pass rate, if you were to ask what is the pass rate of African learners, it will be about 30%. So I think that is one thing that we need to also put on the table. The recent higher education report by the University of Cape Town education professor, Crane Sonder, also points to the same problems in our education sphere, whereby the throughput for black students remain very low. So we are also, as I said, Chairperson, one must not ignore white poverty that is also increasing. We did do research, and we still find that in areas like Bergburg, small mining towns and so on, that phenomena is increasing. So I think We pay attention to that, but we must not ignore that. Therefore, we continue to experience high dropout rates at the basic and higher education sphere. A research that was done by what they call the Mandela children, those who went to school in 1994, found that there was as much as an attrition of 1 million learners who came into the students that could not be accounted for. Because if 1.4 million young people enter school in grade zero or the first grade, and only 300,000 or so, 400,000 write matric, it means somewhere in between, there is an amount as much as 800,000 that has gone somewhere. So the issue of attrition education is very, it still remains high. The result of this is that more than 65% of young people are unemployed. We know that young people constitute 70% of the unemployed. The people who are worst affected are those especially who have not attained matric. Previous reports during the economic growth phase that we experienced between 2007 stated that the reason we experienced growing unemployment despite increasing GDP growth was that jobs were not being created at a pace fast enough to absorb the high number of first labor market entrants. In addition, the low labor absorption rate is due to the fact that most of these new entrants lack the basic skills and education to enhance their employability. This is further compounded, very controversial point I'd like to make, but I was listening to the debate by Colin Brown, Slack, and Cameron. We were talking about immigration. The issue in South Africa about unemployment is further compounded by increase in uncontrolled immigration from neighboring countries. I need not say more, we just had a presentation for 1 hour on our forest borders. And of course, if you eat in our restaurants, you'll know what I'm talking about. These immigrants possess... I'm not xenophobic, I'm just patriotic and a nationalist, Chairman. Because these are the people who vote for us. These immigrants possess the necessary level of skills and education at low wage levels and have thus displaced the youth in this country. My age are not also unionized. Nothing wrong with immigration, but it cannot continue to be uncontrolled. And this is the issue with the European Union, it's the issue in the United States, it has to be an issue in our country. Chairperson, before I move on, I just want to point to you that normally when we talk about young people, we tend to treat them with one broad brush. But they're not the same, they're not homogeneous. They are about seven cohorts, excuse my numbering there, of young people in terms of their economic participation. We have youth in school. This is where the bulk of our budget for young people sits, probably about 90%. Then you've got unemployed youth who are unskilled. That is about 3 to 4 million young people talking about there. Then you've got youth in higher education and training. We're talking there a number of plus minus a million. That will include young people who are in learnerships, FET colleges, universities, etc. Then you've got employed youth, also quite a large number. Of young people who are employed, 35% of those who have been lucky to find jobs. Then you've got unemployed graduates. You're talking a number there of about 300,000 plus or minus and growing. Then you've got youth in conflict with the law. The last report I read by the independent authority that looks at prison reported a number of close to about plus minus 200,000, 144,000 of which were young people. Okay? 60,000 odd who were first time convicts. And then you've got self-employed young people who are very much in the minority, extremely low. So when we talk about young people, this is what we talk about. So that we don't, and we think that there are rural, unemployed, women, and the disabled. But those kind of stratifications would affect any one of those economic cohorts. So that's what we talk about when we talk about young people, so that when one makes the case for what I think we can be able to understand each other. The appropriation bill, so when we talk about high dropouts, we're talking about this second layer of unemployed young people that is growing by more than 150,000, 200,000 every year. The appropriation bill does not reflect any contribution towards reversing this trend and to provide a safety net to those who have dropped out and remain unemployed. And one of the features of unemployment is that structural component of unemployment is high, meaning the problem, if not addressed, is not going to go away even during periods of economic growth after this recessionary period. Because
unemployment is very stubborn. You know, it's people who have been unemployed for 8 years, 7 years, and so forth. They say they are discouraged work seekers. They've given up looking for work. So even when we had increase in employment, there was frictional employment you gain. It's mostly people who have not necessarily dropped out. So you find that when you go into our townships, a lot of people have been unemployed for a long period. Our submission today, and specific recommendation, Chairperson, is that the government ought to invest in the following capacity to address especially these young people who are unemployed, are able-bodied, and are unskilled. The first thing is, we are recommending a creation of skills development centers which have an open entry system. This would be similar to the Job Corps program in the USA, but we don't have to go to the USA. If we do research, and UNICEF found a book not so long ago under the labor and manpower section, that, you know, if you look at the Manpower Act and read all the reports during apartheid South Africa, these skill centers did exist, and they were done away with when the National Skills Development Act was introduced. And also, you mustn't forget that one of them that we're suffering also is that companies that we established to create jobs, like ESCO, were privatized. ESCOM doesn't train as much, etc. So there's a whole lot of capacity. You could argue that it was created for a few minorities, but it created jobs. They created jobs nevertheless. So I personally, Chairperson, went and did, and there were as much as 30 industrial development boards. For example, I went to train for a welding in Portsberg during my high school vacation. And I met with the basic welding certificate in Portsberg. I'm not sure if that's still later. And that was one of the metal steels. So the Building Federation, Building Industry Federation of Africa, if you go to the facilities in Benoni, I think it was sold and now doesn't do anything anymore. Because there was a wrong assumption, Chairperson, that was made, that the seekers and employers will be able to employ many young people. But when you look at the report, since the National Skills Development Act was introduced, you will find that not more than 150,000, 140,000 first-time labor market entrants are being absorbed by all seekers and many employers. And more interesting, the companies that employ the highest number are the big companies. So one cannot therefore rely only on the seeker system for purpose of training, and hence we motivate that there must be skill centers, as we used to have in the apartheid days, which are open entry system where people can go and train for 3 months, for 4 months, and so forth, and progressively acquire the skills that is required. Secondly, we are, and also the argument that was made by the European Union that funded that NSDA was that, no, competency-based training. We have been to India and so on. We have seen competency-based training being done not only by employers. If you go to what they call, also in the United Kingdom, there are those centers as well. So it's not something that is not being done around the world, which are not necessarily aligned to employers, but they're there to cater for unemployed and those people who are looking for skills. We're also arguing for a provision of adequate funding towards the National Youth Service Program. This program, in our view, should be funded to absorb at least 200,000 youth annually, as we did experience during the days of conscription, but this time we want a civilian one. Under the Federal Public Works, there is more quality training that is taking place under the National Youth Service Program and affect young people mostly. The duration participants spend in the NYSP is longer, thus the long-term social capital gain is much higher. Honorable Ramadagan is aware with Chrysalis during his 8 days in the province in the Western Cape. He was the patron of Chrysalis. It's a very good project. So this is some of the things that we're talking about, that we need more of such. The time bomb everybody's talking about is more imminent than we appreciate. And therefore, these measures have to be undertaken urgent. I was just saying, because I've got the protection of Parliament, I was just saying, Chairperson, you know, I was just saying, Chairperson, can you imagine you've got this time bomb, and these are young people mostly are participating. So if you were to have service delivery strike, xenophobia attacks, taxi industrial strike, and all trade unions at strike at the same time, you basically have a civil war on this country. But I'm just saying, you know, and if you look at these service delivery and xenophobia, it's young people who are participating in these things. So I believe that there's one bomb ticking at one point in the time, but I fear that if we don't do something quickly, this time bomb can just become uncontrollable. As you see, somebody was telling me in the plane today that the analysis done was that all of last year, 2008, 104 service delivery protests took place. In this quarter of 2010, 54 in the first quarter. So that begins to tell you that if there were 108 last year, 54 in this quarter, that the numbers are increasing, and these are young people. So I know the Minister of Finance hinted that we are aware that there's work underway to establish the wage subsidy in an endeavor to boost employment for first-time labor market entrants. However, the wage subsidy will not work if the labor pool is not productive due to lack of skills, and this will simply push wages up. And those of us who are aware about accelerated labor market policies will know what we're talking about here. Moving on to small and medium micro-enterprise development. In developing economies, SMEs are generally the biggest source of new jobs being created. In fact, most analysis done on South Africa questioned an anomalous situation found whereby the SME sector, especially micro-enterprises, does not seem to be providing any relief for the high unemployment. Instead, there has been a decline in the number of micro-enterprises formed, which would otherwise enable self-employment. We did research where we found that, for example, and this was done by the micro-enterprise sector representative board, that found the number of micro-enterprises, even in the during the times of increased growth, they were still declining. And there's also research that was done, the Center for Development Studies by Harvard, which was commissioned by National Treasury, did find the same finding, and the growth report that was done by the 21 countries, led by the eminent Nobel Prize professor, found the same things about South Africa, that you are developing towns that your behavior in terms of micro-enterprise and informal economy is behaving differently to what we find in many other countries. During a recessionary budget cycle, and this is the main point we'd like to raise with the committee, private sector funding through banks becomes difficult for SMEs to obtain. As you'll find now, banks have shut down credit because of the recession. This means that government, because government is there to correct the market failure, through these development agencies, has a vital role to play. Now, when you analyze the appropriation bill, it reflects the inadequate resources that have been allocated to agencies that should be supporting the, that should be championing the support of SMEs. And I am not saying, Chairperson, these agencies are angels. I used to run one myself. So I will not say they're angels. There are a lot of mistakes, but I think there's something, there are good that is happening. There's bad things that need to be fixed. So the government is behaving exactly like banks, tightening the allocation instead of being counter-cyclical to address the drying up of private capital. It is imperative that we do the following to increase entrepreneurship activity in South Africa. One, adequately capitalize these institutions dedicated towards supporting SMEs at a national and provincial level and ensure that they work and work well. Two, finalize the process of identifying set aside for procurement and making necessary amendments to the relevant laws that govern procurement, such as the Preferential Procurement Act. Therefore, the appropriation bill in future ought to earmark certain expenditure items that will make the policy change to be underpinned with real procurement budgets. Because when you've got procurement, it's easier to gain access to finance. The third thing is that finance the creation of small business incubation parks to lessen the hurdles that face entrepreneurs. Some of the Bantustan self-governing territories, Mangaube, Dibdis, Patudi, Nimbobo, etc., you find when you go, those things are laying moribund and they don't work anymore. But what they used to do, because they used to, people who used to operate there didn't pay GTS. So as soon as in the New South Africa we started introducing value-added tax, which affected those things, obviously those industries moved away into areas where they would find easy transportation, such as Isando and so forth and so forth. But those facilities are still there. If you go to Harankua, you'll see it. If you go to Sesheko, you'll find it. In my hometown, Mahwelere Mugopan, you'll find it, and so many others. So I believe that it's very important because now they run 100% by private capital. And I believe that we need to see how government can begin to to begin to engage with those kind of facilities and even create more, because this enables entrepreneurs to start. For example, if you talk about an area like Lephala, where there's going to be huge mining happening, I mean, you can have a situation where almost 100% of the input are coming out of the areas when we have people in Port Kitter, Kres, Sor Mubabani, Nelstrom, now called Mudimule, Nabom, now called Mkhopong. There are people there with skills, black and white, who are welders, so and so on, who, with some support, can actually be able to cater for the increasing, you know, coal industry that is growing there. Otherwise, what you see is lots of trucks. You know, so there are certain areas that I believe that those kind of development zones would be helpful. Moving to our conclusion, Chair, on performance measures. The government-wide monitoring and evaluation system was adopted in 2007. In my book, it is not acceptable that we can continue 3 years later to approve budget that does not state what is the desired outcome or result and output for each budget item, so that ordinary citizens, as order that we can track performance, the appropriation bill should only be passed with such information being provided. And this can happen tomorrow, because that information is there, I hope. I mean, this is the kind of, for example, what you give a government program, sub-program. Right now, normally you see appropriation and adjustment. But you don't see output, you don't see outcomes. So, and one would imagine that when we come, so that if when one reads through the appropriation bill, you should be able to comparatively see whether there has been any achievement of outcomes or not. And that is where I make a case that the way the arbitrary nature of our budget kicks in. Because even if a program is not working and it's not effective, it still continues to be given money. You know? So in terms of this equitable allocation, move on to the last point, Chairperson. It is not fair, it is neither equitable nor reasonable that more funding is dedicated to the development of offenders than is dedicated to sports development for the youth of this country. I mean, if you look at the development budget, I'm not even just talking about the whole Department of Correctional Services, there's almost a billion or so dedicated just for these 200,000 odd offenders for their development. And yet, you go to many of our townships, you don't even find a simple sports or an arts facility. Simple, just something simple as that. And I don't think it is fair, I don't think it's equitable, and I don't think it's reasonable. Secondly, black universities who struggle to improve conditions and cater for the poorest of our population receive far less subsidies from government as compared to historically white universities. And these black universities, they struggle to attract private sector support. I mean, I used to be the chairman of the finance committee of the University of Limpopo. You will see 100 companies, one will come in, you know, or two will come in, you know. So I think it's very important that, because they cater mostly for the needy and the poorest, that we need to temper with that adjustment. That formula that is being utilized for allocations to these universities, I think it needs to be revisited. There are more prisons, 217 or more, than there are FET colleges. There are 115 training sites and 50 FET colleges. Now, it doesn't make sense. We cannot say we're a developmental state, and then we have more prison facilities that in some instances cost more than an FET college run. For me, it is unreasonable, it is not fair, and it's not equitable. So I believe that these are some of the things that we need to question. More money has been spent on stadia for the 30 days during the World Cup than has been spent over the last 15 years on facilities in township and rural areas. That could be used every day. You know, when you look at what happened, for example, in Australia. When Australia hosted the Olympics in 2002, whenever the year was, they didn't start from scratch to build community facilities. They were there. These are built, and that's why Australia has moved. If we look at the Olympic record of Australia, why they have improved so much from 1982, and when they hosted the Olympics, they jumped up, right up to number six. It's because they didn't go and build nice, big, sports facilities. They invested in schools and club facilities in local government. And that is what created more achievement. You talk about Cuba. Cuba's sporting athleticism is not because they've got these fancy facilities. It's because of mass sports participation. The same with China. And this is not big monies. These are everyday monies that can be put in our townships, which are not there. In fact, I was feeling one mining company in my township. They funded more a golf facility than it is a crash. So one must not leave out the private sector, because that's also the case here. The amount of funding allocated to Ministry of Women, Children and Civil Service is less than set aside for communication, for example, under the Department of Trade and Industry. They've got an $80 million budget for communication. They have a $72 million budget for the whole year. It doesn't make sense. So I believe that, Chairperson, in conclusion, that one would like to stay involved, but I hope when the budget office is up and running in Parliament, there can be proper and thorough research that can be conducted in terms of the fairness, the equitableness, and the reasonableness of our budget allocation. Because I believe it is arbitrary, it is pro-cyclical, and it is stunting our growth. I rest my case. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Deka. Have you joined court now?
No,
Mr. Ramasagan is not listening.
I'm joining Kosatu.
That's a question. He wasn't listening. Ms. Oras, can I chase you away? Go to the doctor, please. She says she's not well. You are excused. You didn't hear what I was saying. I was asking. You know, it's like this. We're talking about the development of state when you have more prisons than FTC. I'm asking them if you have joined COP now. You know. So the last time I saw it. Now I think that colleagues, on a serious note, we have very valuable what we call inputs. How I wish we could have had more what you call submission, but it is a start. We're going to get there. Honourable members, there is your presentation.
Chair, you referred to COVID. I thought this was written by a researcher of the DA. It's a very good document. It speaks the truth.
No, of course.
Mm. If I just refer to education, I've got a figure here that there are 1,700 teachers in South Africa that teach science. I'm qualified and I'm not really allowed to teach science. Which means that something like 50,000 learners are being taught science by somebody that cannot teach them science because they don't understand it themselves. Our education has been transformed into an expensive nothingness because basically what they should be focusing on is skills development so that people can become welders and plumbers and that kind of thing. So they can get jobs. This is what the companies are looking for, and they will give them jobs. I'm very pleased that the government is now working towards reintroducing the apprenticeship system and the training colleges. The CETAs are non-functional, basically. I mean, they're worth nothing. But I would like to hear the presenter's view on the question of in what way labor legislation is adversely affecting the possibility of job creation, because that is one of the most important things. Because if you look at China, for instance, there we have high productivity, low wages, and I'm not getting low wages, but I'm just saying, we are so stringent in our labor laws that, we want to do away with everything, and there's no growth. In other words, if I'm prepared to work for 50 rand a day, it's better for me to work for 50 rand a day than to have nothing. I'm just saying that not as an example, because it's a bad example, but I'm just saying, our labor laws are very stringent. And the same thing with SMEs. It is so difficult for these people to form a company. It takes them 2 months to form a little company because they've got to register here and register there and get this finance and get that approval before they can actually start up a business. and you know that should be simplified. I've never heard of any trade union who comes to the bargaining table and says, we would like a 10% increase and we promise you a 10% productivity increase. They just say we want 10%, thank you very much. And they fight and they strike, as you say, until they get to 10% and that's it. But no increase in productivity. And I think that should become part of our labor legislation as well. But in any case, thank you for the presentation. I enjoyed that, Chair. And I, you know, with a few exceptions, a few things that I disagree with, I won't take it up with you, but I think it was a good presentation.
Thank you very much,
Honorable Rabbi.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honorable Rabbi, okay, I have
Chairperson, no, thanks. I also want to say I really appreciated the presentation here this morning. I think the point that was very clear was about the technical schools. I think that is, I think if you look at, especially in India and China, where the economy starts in China, but Berlin plant. Mm. Now what happened in China is what happened. I think that we must aim to look at that. 6 weeks, once the different provinces there are providing different skills to the building industry. But there are 6 weeks training, 6 weeks practical, and 6 weeks background training. And I think I agree with him, and I think that is the government, the ANC government, is on this way to bring back the technical schools. I think that is very important for us. Because you are right, there were electrical skills in Benoni. Mm-hmm. It was the plumbing, and I think by the change we made there, I think we made some mistakes. In the Southern Cape, we have, for instance, you know, the technical schools there. My view is that is also a problem we experience today in the local government. You have engineers, but the best engineers were the people who get their school in the technical school, or their skills in the technical school. From there, they go to university, but they have the practical background. Most of the engineers today don't have this practical background. They are very intelligent, but they haven't got the practical background. So I want to tell you, I think on that point, I'm glad that you make it. That's a very important point. And then it is the biggest challenge for us. Job creation. Because in where I came from, it is terrible yesterday morning, where people stand next to the road, and it is not tense. 2 or 3 years ago, it was 10, 15. It's now hundreds. They are only looking for a job for them. People that are very good qualified. Very good qualified. And I say, yes, give me a garden job. Now, it's for me, I saw it last week. And a person came and said, listen, here's my qualifications. But I haven't got a job. So I think we have to change that. And I think that the government is doing something on that. But I agree with you. That is the biggest change. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks very much for the presentation. I'm having a problem here because these recommendations on the that stage are very, very good. And it brings me to the issue of FETs. When we talk about FETs, we want more of them. But we have this issue which I think you should help us address. And I wonder how you manage to with your observation when you were still in your past life, how you observed it, because the entrance to SETs, which are very, very important, seems to be undermined by our children. I don't know whether we brought our children up to say they must go to university or what, or is it the promotion of how SETs were promoted? Because its intake seems to be very taken as an inferior institution, whereas a lot of good things can come out of that. and we have a few of them. I know I once wanted to engage you in Mabatlan, but one of the people who I think is your friend said, no, a lot is being done there. So let him not come here because we can address, because areas like Mabatlan, Thabazimbi don't have an FET. And how are we going to address the skills development if there's such big areas which are around the same place and do not have an FET? I just want to know how you came up across it in your past life and what you thought about it. Did you ever do any survey or a little research around that so that out of what it comes, something can be done? Because I think this is a very, very good presentation, and a person like you can give us some idea of how to address those vast areas without skills development institutions, except those ISCO institutions, which sometimes can cater for everybody. I just want to know, and the impression of the youth about the FETs. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I just want to repeat that I think it was a good presentation. I want to leave it there, not comment further in terms of the plan.
Say, I want to hear what you're doing now about
the Chair, then the interesting point about the formula, the kind of funding formula for university. I know that there's been lots of talks about the task team or the commission that was looking on the same issue. I'm just wondering whether you've been able to have an insight of the recommendation or the report. I haven't seen a report that suggests that there should be a different approach in terms of the funding, including the institution that provide assistance to learners that are coming from poorly disadvantaged community in terms of affordability at the university itself. Whether you have been having or maybe privy to that in relation to the point you make around the issue of the renewal of the formula, funding formula for university. The investment in education you speak about in terms of the magnitude of it, and the question really in terms of that I want to pose to you is the following. You said the budget is counter-cyclical, that cyclical, yeah. But you're saying that in terms of education, the education has been pumped a lot of money in terms of, but the quality and the quality basically at the end of it, it does not overwhelm in terms of the budget itself. So the two doesn't do the comparison. Now, the question that confronts us here, including the department, will be what is to be done? What is to be done to change that around? If the entrance level and the actual results for matric results, you're talking 300,000, 400,000, you're talking huge. The people that falls out in between from the grade 1 to 12. So something must be done, and you're talking about the skill development, the centers that were there before, that could be the one that's holding arrangement in terms of it. So the question in that would be, are you suggesting that the education budget should be restructured to make provision for these centers that you're talking about, the center for training? Are you saying that that's what has to happen? And if it has to happen, it has to happen within this bulk or this big money that is given
less results that you actually see. So is that what you're suggesting, that because that will probably help me to think about the whole cycle of education budget and maybe pay attention to that, because the debate has always been that education will address this issue that we addressed before by all this, what is a subsect training center for that and that, and 16 years down the line we're saying it's quite not working. We perhaps have to go back to that basic. So that's the question I'm really asking in terms of your submission around that issue. Or do you think that there should be additional quantified quantity to be deployed in that particular area on top of what has already been deployed in the education? And if the answer is yes, you still have this issue about education and the outcome, the output, in terms of the actual learners that actually end result in matric. But I think that may well be an unfair question to expect that it's only one institution that has a responsibility to make sure that learners don't drop off while they're on the journey to matric. It may well be a couple of measures that you need. It's a societal issue, it's the condition, it's the environment, it's the demand, it's the peer pressure, all those kind of things plays together. It may well be a package of how you deal with that particular question. But I'm just looking at the end result in terms of government, where we have at least capacity to influence. And I can't agree with you more around the issues about the performance and the measurable output in terms of the structuring of the budget. So you can see what is expected to be outcome and output of that particular budget. I don't agree with that.
Can I tell you a quick story? Just on what you said. Just a follow-up. The school in the Western Cape with the highest increase in matric pass rate was from 58% to 82%. Was the Imazamo Yetu school in Timbaletu in George. And I went to visit them, and I saw the headmaster, and I said, now, have you got any problems with discipline in the school? He said, no. He says, because the first thing in the morning, he keeps a record of all the teachers that are late. If he's late twice, he reports into the department, and disciplinary action is taken. And what he means by late is he must be in the classroom, and he must know that all the learners are there, and must give him a list of all the learners that are not there. But they increased the pass rate to over 80% in that school, and it's intimidated, the black school, the discipline is great, and I think that's one of the things that I would just like to add, you know, to the things which Honorable Ramaphosa, and that we require discipline back in school.
Okay.
I think a number of issues that you've raised are incredibly complex, but they're also incredibly important that they need to get dealt with. At this level, I don't know to the depth that we can deal with those issues too, but what I'd really like to see happening is that our researchers take this paper and pick it to pieces in the form of packaging it, so that we can get, there's some deep thought that's in there, and that thought must eventually make drive policy or drive budget, so that we can interact, even if it's not in a meeting sense, with all the relevant departments, but it must be the planning and evaluation, the presidency, it must be treasury, it must be whatever it is. I think they need to be able to let us know their kind of thought processes that are going into these issues too, so that when these budgets start to come next year, we're able to start preparing ourselves now to be able to push things in a direction that we believe needs to be achieved. And really, I think there's a lot of food for thought in this country.
Okay, thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I think the comment made about teachers and the fact that you know, they don't have sufficient number of qualified teachers, and I think it was Professor Tienz Ilo from University of Northwest. I was in one meeting with him, on the GIPSA meeting, where he said that the, you know, that we have stopped training especially like if you want to have a lot of ICT colleges, you also have to train people who, when they've qualified as engineers, they also do education and so on, so they go and teach. And they find that that capacity is not there, and that's what you'd find in other economies. So I think that's one of the things that we need to look at, because just to teach somebody, and also encourage people who are also doing engineering and so forth to look at as a viable, career option. In terms of the labor legislation and the impact on employment, a specific question which is not necessarily on the budget, but I believe that unless we relax some of the conditions that affect first-time labor market entrance, it will be very difficult for us to introduce the wage subsidy, and it will also be very difficult for us to have a different dispensation for first-time labor market entrance. Because if you as a small business person find it very difficult to hire and fire, it becomes very discouraging. And hence, I think partly has encouraged a lot of employers to even go to the extent of employing immigrants legally, because that's how it is. One does not say people after maybe a year or two, because people cannot be part-time forever either, that you would want to say that person definitely in terms of a decent job and benefits and so forth, that they must benefit from those so that they don't continue to almost be like scrap labor, on a permanent basis. But I think that there has to be a different dispensation to enable the introduction of the wage subsidy, because it's going to be a developer. One of the issues is going to be that, it can't be that after a first year of giving somebody an opportunity, then there is an automatic expectation for employment. I think that would be discouraging. And I think that's something that we need to look at. COSATU, I know, in the main, has objected, to the concept of wage subsidy and 2002 policy conference of the ANC, they shut down the whole issue of a different dispensation for first-time labor market entrance. But unfortunately, we live in a global as well. Capital goes to where it's easier to do business. So, I sat with the CEO of Cisco and just asked him why is he moving his headquarters from South Africa to Dubai. I said, well, it's easier to hire, and also he raised the issue of crime and safety, that's, unfortunately, when you talk about you want to attract fixed foreign direct investment, unfortunately, those are things that they're looking at. And they have to decide between India, where they've got more skilled people, and relaxed labor legislation in South Africa, which is the opposite. You can't argue like in Sweden, because they don't have an inequality problem. And nor are the numbers so big. Czech Republic, Sweden, and so forth. There are very few people there. So, and in fact, they are interesting immigrants coming to cope with the lower labor. And obviously, they also have an ageism problem, that a lot of their population is aging very quickly, and many young people leave or are not having children, or they're having small families. In South Africa, the conditions are different. So, we have to look at it. And I think, if South Africa wants to, because it's not good enough for us to be part of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. We also have to look at what are the things that Brazil, Russia, India, and China are doing. Also look at the development of Ireland and South Korea, because I think those are also very comparative. And I do have literature that one can share with honorable members on those development trajectories that have been followed by those economies. So I think it's very important to look at that, as to what is happening there. And you know what? I often feel that unions argue for people who are employed, and not necessarily for people who are unemployed. But I think if you are unemployed and you're waking up every day for 8 years, and really the last thing on your mind is actually about joining a union or being unionized. It's actually just about getting money, and putting food on your table. I know it from my nephews, my uncles, my cousins, and so on. I don't need research for that. Tell your story. When I was getting married, I got shot by 1,000 rand. And I was helped by a cousin of mine who was digging pipes for installation of pipes in the school. He only worked for 3 weeks and he made 1,000 rand. He had not worked up until he was 32. The amount of pride compounded with the fact that I was short 1,000 and he helped me. He always reminds my wife, I married you too. So he didn't care about the fact that he only got 1,000. The fact is, it was the highest amount of money he ever had in his pocket.
Now, when to make it difficult for such people to get jobs, I think the dispensation becomes a little bit difficult. So I would argue that we need to do that, especially on small business. You want to find somebody, you must go to CCMA and Q. I don't know. I think there's a certain level of businesses that should actually be excluded from compliance to such a requirement. That's my view, and could be found to be quite neoliberal, but that's what it is. As Jefferson said, there's no homogeneity in the ANC on board. So, and that's what makes it very exciting, the school of the ANC. Now, on LDP schools, and how the whole inflation of young people, I just want to say first, I made a presentation to the Minister of Education, Naledi Pandor, then. I said, and I was saying this from my own experience. I learned to be a mechanic by the time I was in matric. I could change plugs. I could tell you if you're operating at that thing, what spanners would work where. I knew what was a top spanner. I knew everything because for me to get pocket money, I visited my brother-in-law's scrapyard and panel beating shop from the time when I was around about 11. So by the time I did my trick, if you got stuck in your car, even today, I can help you. Because I know exactly how the engine works. I'm not an expert. I only know carburetor engines, I must also add, not fuel injection. But the point I'm trying to make, and I made this in a GIPS account, is that often we delay the whole concept of skills development until people have passed my trick. In Tunisia, from when you're in grade 8, you can choose between following a skills-intensive, labor-intensive route, or you can follow the academic route. And they do meet somewhere as well. So if you went the technical route, you can also rejoin the academic route if you want to be a professor in materials and so forth. And I really believe that, one thing about the Chinese, we talk about the Chinese, they plan for 50 years. We mustn't be short-termism in our view, in our approach. That we must start now and say 50 years from now, and hopefully the National Planning Commission will come with ideas, 50 years from now, this is what we'd like to see, and begin to build those kind of capacities and change our system, because 100 years from now, South Africa will still be there. So that, for me, will be the first thing, that to introduce young people in the FET system, we should actually be starting earlier than after matric. And then also, I think there's more communication issues, just to show people who are working, and so we found that the more and more career guidance that takes place in our school, if we can really strengthen career guidance in our schools, because many high schools don't even have career educators. So many young people really is fine by trial type of thing. So I think we need to do that to promote FET schools is on career education and job shadowing. When we're young, we're taking buses to NTK and so on. So those kind of things, by school trips, I think those will help. The funding formula on higher education, I've seen the report on one on transformation, which I released recently. NESFAS, also the report, but I haven't seen the one on funding formula. There's something that one could pursue. But I really believe that one needs to look at, for example, there needs to be certain checks and balances that are put in place. Depending, for example, if you just did a regression analysis to look at the levels of income of people employed in a particular university, and then when you do a subsidy, then compensate for it. And I think those some of the things are happening. I don't think the formulas are aggressive enough to address for the fact that University of Limpopo, 80% of students there, 80% of students, who come from University of Limpopo, they will struggle to find jobs, and they come from poor families who cannot afford to pay their fees. Now, what happens in those universities in terms of national allocation? And that's in the report. They make inadequate amount, such that very little is shared between many, as a result of which they end up with not being able to fulfill their studies. And I think that is something in the public domain. But I'm not sure if there is a report, and I'll follow it up. In terms of the outcome and education budget, what is to be done? I've got specific comments. One is, I sound like Brown campaigning for office. I was just watching that debate, on specific NPS. I think the reopening of education colleges, it is a recommendation by many political parties in their manifestos of the study. I think that is there. It's not, it's something that is there. Also the ongoing training of teachers in, you know, that once teachers are in, that we must make sure that there's ongoing training that is taking place. But I also think one of the things I've seen with my own children, early childhood development. Because I think that for most kids who don't, and some kids just go to crash, but it's not necessary that they're being developed early. So they engage with numbers, with computers, with everything else when they are 9 or something like that. They're very late, you know, in the system. So I think part of what, I think the EPWP has been talking a lot about the early childhood development program under the EPWP, and I think it needs to be fast-tracked. Because I think that's quite important. Because in many, many countries, you know, education achievement is not boosted by people just coming now. It starts very early on. If some of you watch China TV, CCTV, you'll see what those kids are put through by the time they're 5, 6, the work ethic training and those kind of things. And then another thing is, and this is controversial, but we must introduce and adopt performance management on teachers. It cannot simply be the case that somebody continues to teach math, the students continue to fail, that person continues to teach math year after year, and you expect a different outcome. That is wrong. So I really believe we need to introduce performance management on teachers, and that, for me, I think is very important. Also to inform what kind of development we need to put in place. And also the other thing about social conditions dropout, I can tell you, you see, some of the things that happened, for example, when I grew up, there was a lot of the mission schools, and there was also a lot of missions, like Lutheran Church, and so on and so on, and Roma, and we had a lot of people from Poland. I mean, there was a father, something from, in Bukhara, who came from Roma. He taught us piano, we did monkey jive, we did also. We're still members of the ANC Youth League by night, you know, but during the day, there was a lot of opportunities for sports and recreation, with churches and anti-apartheid donor-funded NGOs used to provide. Now, you must remember that funding, when we became free, went to treasury, and very little of it went to those NGOs. So, as a result, and many of you in the NGOs went and joined government. As a result, that NGO movement that used to support sport and recreation and those kind of things died. And I think it's important that in our fiscal and allocation, we begin to look at such issues. How do we re-energize those kind of movements? School clubs, sports clubs in communities, etc., etc. And I know that the lottery is trying, but I don't think it goes further enough. And then also, I agree that in all schools, there's the connection between governance and performance. I mean, there's a school in Venda that gets 100% for the last 10, 15 years, and that has been the consistent thing. Lastly, Chair, we had a program, for example, where we're taking people who are in higher education to go and teach on Saturdays in schools. So I think that's something that we need to look at. But I would volunteer, Chair, pro bono, to work with your budget office in terms of the comment that was made to further interrogate, because it is my passion. It's something that I'm really dedicated towards. And we have, you know, it's something that for the rest of my life I'll always be pursuing until we have a better life for all. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I never saw things like that. I talk too much. He has not met you. Well, thank you very much. I think that...
Too long.
So his responses were very short.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, precise. Okay. No, it's fine. I think that we... Thank you very much for the submission. Honorable Swart says, these submissions are very valuable. But there are things that maybe need to be interrogated. I'm not sure if you're yearning for apartheid, that we should go back to apartheid.
Unintended
consequences. Okay. Now let me allow me to finish, because some of those training centers, they were not training centers in the true sense of the word, because people could spend a number of a few days there. They would give, you know, in Chamdo, I think there was one day in Binoni, there was another one, and I think all over the country. A week, and you couldn't say a person who spent a week there is really what you call got
training, but there was some training of some sort. But I think that the other thing is maybe is to look at the speeches of the ministers of education, especially the now that the government has realized that the clearly sitters are non-starters now, has been taken over by the Ministry of Higher Education and the restructuring of those that are in the process. The minister pronounced in his budget speech, I think it would be useful if you could look at that. But I agree with you that with a whole, what you call it, a range of things. But again, I think that the government led by the ANC has, is really looking at a whole a range of things. And one of the things that really worry me is the report on the DFI, so this Development Finance Institution. You know, people apply from my constituency. I see people who apply and then sit out there for ages, just waiting for the response that will say, "We regret to inform you." They are supposed to be developmental in nature, but in implementation, cannot be really useful, helpful to those people who need those things. The issue is the development institutions are there, but the implementation it is the greatest, what we call a problem. I think that the members, they are happy that you're sharing a cooler. Mm. You must ask anyone to go to cooler. People will just look around. They will think that you're not serious if you're sending a person to cooler. Because they're not going to get help. And I think that it's not within our ambit, this committee, it's not our mandate to look at those DFIs, but I've been asking for those reports. I think from 2008 or so, we were told that there was going to be reports from DFI. They are not there. We have not seen those reports. Maybe what we could do is to invite them to come here one by one or so and say, tell us what you really want to do. I think that, well, you're quite right. I mean, many members have agreed with your presentation in terms of performance management, this allocation. But I think that it's very difficult to... I appreciate what people in government have been trying to strike a balance between those people who are already in prison. How do you say to this person who is already in prison, this person mustn't go back to prison? Because it's one, that's why they call them correctional statements, so that the contribution could be to correct their ways of living, so that they can make now a positive contribution to society. Now, how do you strike those without also, giving some resources to ensure that those people do that? I think that your presentation really tells us that there's a lot of information that is out there. But what we would really have loved in future, this is our first appropriation bill that we have been handling. This committee has made a resolution that the people who present must submit to the committee 3 days or so this submission. I think the usefulness of that would be to say, also to invite other people who can be able to respond to some of these submissions, to
your submissions are important, but you must be able to get some precise responses from department. What is being done about this? What is being done about this? Your submission, for instance, was is cutting across. So we could have invited a number of people to say, what is it that is being done? We were listening now, or we are busy, parallel to what we are doing, listening to the budget of departments. They are presenting their budget, promising this and that. So the responses would be good. But, I mean, your critique, for instance, of the stadium, it's not unfounded. But the LOC speaks about the legacy as well. Legacy is one thing, but I think that what is clear, even from the coach, is that as far as development is concerned, we really leave much to be desired. Because it's a professional soccer, our professional league, for instance, we have a professional league here, and under that, there are no, what you call it, other leagues that would really fit into that. So it's clear that we're going to have difficulty in reaching the level of other people. But to me, the issue is that people have identified these loopholes. Now, the question is, what do we do with those issues once they are identified? Because when you are identifying them, you must say we must be able to deal with them. You know, earlier the one colleague, I think it was Honorable Snell, who was saying this presentation and your presentation, we have dealt with other presentations and the process of how to deal with this. But yours is clear that the suggestion that you have made, the Comrade Mayor, of how we should follow up on one by one of this issue, so that at the end we can really be able to say the submission has really received justice. Because he is being, obviously he will be attended to. But I think that the last comment is to say that you'll be now be on our database. I think that only comments perhaps that we may need in dealing with the issues that have been raised. We will invite you to come and assist us. And I think that honourable members, these are the issues that have been raised, and I think that they were dealt with. We have not responded, but we're just saying these are some of the issues that are there that exist. I mean, the other important issue that I didn't mention is the issue of direct investment, whether it's foreign or local. Unless we cannot achieve our goal of creating decent jobs, let alone what EPWP is doing, but decent jobs, we'll have to succeed there. Our manifesto is very clear. I know that we can't respond on everything, but we will take up these issues with the relevant department. I would, Honorable Mashiko, are you having your hand?
No.
I would really like to thank you on behalf of the committee, and appreciate the interest that you have shown. And thank you very much, Comrade Kekana. It is clear that when these policies of the ANC finally come to the public, there's a lot that goes into it.
And another sad thing, but now maybe sometimes there's something like I know. Well, thank you very much. I think that we are done with this submission. I'm sure we agree with the summary of, as was pointed out by Honorable Snell, in terms of how we're going to deal with this. The next submission, the next meeting that we're going to have will be on Friday. It does not appear in our program. I'm told. No, there's always been. No. Sorry?
Now we're
going to
change the flight to
being there. No, that's one. In fact, if you remember, it's, I'm not sure, maybe it wasn't an omission, but we had always, it's around the honor of Mashiko. That's the finishing. I know it's a homeboy. I think we had agreed that we must invite Water Affairs. Just to clarify something. It should not be a meeting that should take long. But let us start at half past nine so that by 11 o'clock we will be done. All right. And your flight...
12 o'clock.
Your flight is 12 o'clock. No, for a 12 o'clock flight, you'll be late. It will be at 11:30.
Past
10, 11 o'clock, in fact even 11 for traffic. But I'm sure not all the members leave at that time. The problem is we need to conclude this thing. We can't leave them hanging all the time. Yeah, sure. The wind is spoken now. So, colleagues, thank you very much. But that's why we're not. I was talking to Honorable Mashiko earlier and Honorable Haroklo about this thing that you're talking about. And when Honorable Ramatagane arrived, it was difficult to say he was late because there were a number of communications that reached people. It didn't indicate very clearly as to what is the correct time. But I think that what we should do is to agree that maybe people should confirm in writing, I mean, with the SMS that is sending out, that if the meeting is starting at 9:30, like we're requesting that on Friday, so that we could finish till 9:30, we start and members could be free in. But I would like to apologize for all the any inconvenience that was called this morning, both to our guests and to ourselves as members. But we will improve. We will definitely improve. Togo is out. She's writing exams this week, but she did come this morning just to ensure that things were running smoothly. So my apologies, and this meeting then. Then adjourn until 5.